It's Friday, and that means that it is another edition, number 56, of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, where Jeremy and I, John, business partners at Zogby Strategies, take a look at the news of the week, both the political news and the news well beyond the political news about trends, and share some thoughts, oftentimes from two distinct points of view, but always in a very civil and respectful sort of way. How are you doing this week, Jer?
I'm great. And that's the key word, civil.
Civil. Another key word is that generally over the last several months, Jeremy and I have been sitting in the same room. And in the interest of full transparency, it is 0 degrees outside and I did not want to leave the house. And so there are no major exotic reasons for our being separate, except that it's too cold outside. So with that said and out of the way, I'm going to start. And obviously the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. And as we speak, the impeachment managers from the House, all Democrats, of course, who issued the article of impeachment, have presented their case, and I think very effectively. In fact, I think the evidence that they have presented against the former president are incontrovertible, are clear, are reasonable beyond any doubt whatsoever that the president incited violence on January 6th, and that that, given the fact that the Senate has already voted 55 to 45, that it is proper and constitutional to have this trial, even though the president has left office. I think they've laid that to rest sufficiently. The issue then becomes, are there enough Republican senators? There'll have to be 17 of them to convict the president. That looks highly doubtful. But with that said, the case was made strongly, number one. Number two is that in terms of the internal Republican politics, what we find is that in a CBS poll, 47% of self-identified Republicans said it is very important, not just important, very important to remain loyal to the president. Overall, 56% of the public feels that the president should be convicted. But again, you have that magic number that keeps cropping up of 42 or 43%, mainly Republicans, of course, who feel that he should not be convicted. That's where we stand. I, for one, now after the prosecutorial case, feel that the president should be convicted. And I can cite a lot of the reasons that the impeachment managers stipulated, but no need to go into that now. I will as we converse. Where do you stand on it, Jerry?
I find myself drowning out the political discussions more and more. Yeah, to me, if President Trump gets impeached, it's fine. If he doesn't, it really matters nothing to me. What matters to me is that there's a healing in this nation. I'm not quite sure that that's the best way to go about it, because I think that Trump's base would interpret that as crushing them. And so what comes from that after, you know, Trump supporters, whatever the percentage is, from the voters who, you know, on the side of Trump who think that he shouldn't be, they're going to feel crushed. And so you put that aside, and, you know, to me, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, or elephant, or, you know, whatever beast you want to talk about, is the intensification, the intensity on both sides, the intensity from the flow of information from the right-wing mainstream media outlets to the left-wing mainstream media outlets. What I see happening is people are being pushed down the rabbit hole. And, you know, the rabbit hole, going so far down the rabbit hole, can become a dangerous thing, because then there's no coming back. So you have this dynamic where on the right and on the left, people are going so far towards intensity to the point where objectively looking at it, it's dangerous. It's not just dangerous on the right. It's not just dangerous on the left. It's dangerous in both camps. You have, you know, conspiracy theories on the right, like QAnon, right? We've talked about that. A lot of people have heard about QAnon. I wonder how many people know what the general belief is. You know, the general belief from my standpoint of QAnon was this trust the plan, you know, there are these workings from behind the scene. The military tribunals are coming. Trust the plan, even after it's clearly evident that Trump's not coming back, still trust the plan. The military tribunals are coming. People are going to get arrested. Well, that's obvious that that's not happening. But don't ignore that on the left, you have dangerous ideas that are becoming mainstream in a totally different way. That's ripping apart the social fabric. That's ripping apart families. You know, the extreme wokesterism of, you know, math is racist. Studying the classics, get rid of it. It just emboldens whiteness. And so to me, the impeachment, I understand for a lot of people this is very important, but I personally want to step away from it, because it's the crux of the problem. It's just another thing for people to fight over and for people to become more intense about. And so to me, that I don't want to say it's not important. It's just not going to lead us anywhere. What I'm discovering that's going to lead us somewhere, if we're going to move forward, is to put aside politics. There was a time when political discussion was useful. Now it's become a circus, and actually bred in circus, violence. And so there has to be a return to civics. And I would argue that there's far more discussion that's going to lend itself to enlightening discussion if we make a very strong effort to return to civics and put aside politics. But I just don't see that happening. And case in point, the news of the day is impeachment, and I don't see how that's going to bring about any healing.
So this is a nation that was founded as an idea, democracy and freedom, civil and human rights. It was also a nation based on a constitution of laws. And with laws come accountability. And in that sense, then, any effort to destroy hurt that constitution, denigrate that constitution, becomes a serious violation, not only the law, but of the idea as well. The facts on the ground are that President of the United States lost an election. Fundamentally, someone who loses has to be willing to give up power. That's how we measure whether other countries have moved in a democratic representative form of government or not. And we cheer those countries in Africa and Latin America when they do make smooth transitions of power. The United States is losing that image when it has someone who says, "I really won by a landslide," and then offers no proof for that, because there isn't any. It's also a denigration of the process when someone says, "I have 74 million votes, I need to be respected." But when the other person gets 81 million votes, those are the rules of engagement. The person with 81 million votes wins over the person with 74 million votes. With that said, though, there have been a lot of quotable quotes. I think that the impeachment managers have done a solid job. But the one quote that sticks out in my mind is by Representative Liu from California, who said, and I'm paraphrasing, "I don't care if Donald Trump runs again. I care if he loses again. Because if he loses again and this Congress, the Senate, does not convict him for how he lost and what he launched, then we have the potential to do that again. The rioting encouraged by the President of the United States. When does that stop? And the only way to stop it is, well, it's too late to say nip it in the bud, but it is to say to hold him accountable."
I can't disagree with that, right? Accountability, nation of laws. When people do something wrong, they should be held accountable. The problem is that right now, it's convenient for one side to say, well, it's the other side that's doing things wrong. Our side, it hasn't done anything wrong. I mean, we're getting to the point where what I want to say really should just be, in my view, objective and common sense. But we're in such an intense battlefield, political battlefield. We used to call it a political landscape. Now it's a political battlefield that, to be honest with you, I'm afraid to say what I want to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Go ahead, put Trump in prison. Impeach him for inciting a riot. But don't pretend for one second that previous presidents shouldn't be tried for crimes against humanity. Don't forget that George W. Bush led this nation into a war that was based on lies. Why isn't he tried as a war criminal? Don't forget the fact that Obama led this nation into a war that was dubbed a humanitarian war in the nation of Libya, where to this day, human beings are sold on the marketplace. Slavery utterly destroyed a nation, called it a humanitarian war. That by definition is a war criminal. What about Hillary and the obstruction of evidence? So it's the thing, it goes back to what I said. It's like, if we're gonna talk about national laws and holding people accountable, it can't be one-sided. It has to be across the board. But we have devolved into a nation of whimsical emotions and well, whatever's politically, you know, advantageous for the party that is in power, then call for justice, but never for the party that in many other ways or in similar ways is also guilty of similar crimes. So that is not a nation of laws. So to me, it's like, if you're not going to prosecute across the board, then don't prosecute at all.
I'll make no excuses for the actions of previous presidents. Look, George W. Bush clearly lied, leading us into a war in Iraq for no other reason than he wanted to. Whether it was revenge against Saddam or there was a genuine belief that he could change the geopolitics of the region and turn it into a democratic region that would be permanent allies to the United States. That wasn't just foolish, that was arrogant, and it was criminal. In terms of Obama and Libya, I'm not gonna make any excuses for that. We are in the here and now, and we have had 4 years of a president who did nothing else but flout the law, feather his own nest in terms of promoting his business, the emoluments of office, thumbed his nose, and perhaps, I'm not going to say worst of all, because they're all bad, he enabled white supremacy. He gave it a cushion. He These weren't signals. This was clear English language, what he was saying, what he said on January 6th, but what he said throughout his presidency.
And during the debate, right? During one of the debates, call out white supremacy, silence, right?
Yeah. And so in that regard, even though he's out of office now, what's the precedent to be established now? Do elections not matter anymore? Does a full-scale attack, and you watch the videos, and that's clearly what it was. There was murder, mayhem, and violence that was present on January 6th as the windows and the doors were kicked in and hammered in. Do we excuse that, or do we say, well, let's forget about the past and move forward? I think not.
No, I agree, but again, it's the silence. It's only outrageous and disgusting when the other side does it, right? But we had, I mean, you know, again, very similar things are happening on the other side, right? So Trump incites a riot, and it's inexcusable, and people should be brought to prosecution. Those who desecrated the Capitol Hill, those who obviously all of the people can be figured out with, you know, with drones and cell phone footage that caught most of it. You could prosecute every single one of those people, and they should be prosecuted because that's called trespassing and it's called a riot. But remember, this nation had riots, and you had a party, and you had major outlets of the media that wanted to paint it in another picture. You know, there's that classic CNN footage of, you know, I think it was Minneapolis or maybe it was Portland in the background, ablaze and, you know, on fire. And the, you know, the little blip on the screen read, you know, fiery but mostly peaceful. I mean, are you kidding me? So when one side acts violently, it's punishable, it's disgusting, it's killing our nation. But when another side does it, we're going to use empathy and we're going to understand it. When one leader does something horrible, right, punish him and punish his followers, and maybe even, you know, some people are saying deprogram them. Some people are saying put them on a list and let's use sophisticated algorithms to predict who the future terrorists are going to be. But that discussion was barely talked about when our nation went up in flames over the summer. So that is not a nation of laws. That is whimsical.
There is no moral equivalence here. There is no.
All I was just going to say was this is the fall of the republic. If we don't get serious about justice, then don't expect anything to change.
Bottom line here, there is no moral equivalence here. This is tantamount to the president saying after the rioting and actually the murder in Charlottesville, there are good people on both sides. There were not good people on one side at all. And those were clearly the whole purpose of that rally in Charlottesville was the white supremacy rally. And there were white nationalists, Nazis, that were present there. There were not good people on both sides. There may have been, certainly were on one side, but not on the other. Now, with that said, so what do we do with a former president then who clearly, unequivocally incited a riot that did cause, number one, death, destruction, serious injury, and a tremendous waste of both human and financial and military resources. What do you do?
What do you do? You prosecute him. Yeah. But you it's also civil. Prosecute all politicians that are guilty of other crimes. I'm not going to say the same crimes, because Cuomo didn't incite a riot. Pelosi didn't incite a riot. But make no bones about it, there is a long list of politicians who are guilty of various crimes. And that's the only way to uphold a nation built on laws is to make justice across the board. That's it.
All right, I'm gonna disagree strongly, but let's move on, okay? So the president has a stimulus package before Congress now. They're ironing out the details of what's involved, using reconciliation, because it's clear that there is not sufficient Republican support to treat it as one united package. That would require 60 votes, and it doesn't look like that there would be 60 votes for it. There may have been 60, just barely 60 or 61 votes, if President Biden had determined to go along or negotiate with a compromise package that was put together by 10 Republicans wanting a deal, but he opted to not go that route. What do you think? Should Biden, in the interests of future compromise, settled for a much smaller package, or should he continue to hold his ground?
I don't know. What I want to know is what's the appropriate amount, right? Mm-hmm. What's the appropriate amount of the relief? You know, is it $1,400? Is it $900? Is that insulting? You know, I would imagine, you know, with the fact that poverty has gone through the roof in this country, that may as well be crumbs, right? With the amount of debt that we have in this nation, you know, one of those checks may be able to pay off just a little bit of debt, or it could put food on the table, but the debt remains. I'm talking personal debt, but then don't forget about the fact that the nation is in debt. I'm of the belief, and I know mainstream economists would disagree with this, but my belief is, just like me, I can't consume more than I take in. If I consume more than I take in, then I face bankruptcy. I think the laws of economics would argue that the same is true for governments. You can't just say that individuals and households can go bankrupt, but no, governments can never go bankrupt, because, especially the United States, because all they have to do is just print dollars. And printing dollars, well, everybody in the world wants dollars. Well, that's actually not true. China and Russia are building an entire infrastructure for the future to operate outside of the SWIFT system and outside of the US dollar. And so what you're going to see at some point in the future is the dollar is going to lose its reserve status, and that's going to have a lot of pain. So that's an entire different part of the question that's very difficult to have and very uncomfortable. But, you know, that should be a part of the discussion, but it's not.
So, you know, arguably in 2020, the post-COVID election, no one really ran as a fiscal conservative during the election. Now, the problems are acute. And there are two things I want to say. One is, going back historically to Franklin Roosevelt and the serious situation that he met in 1933, just reading Studs Terkel, you know, and other accounts. Yep. And, you know, some of the poignant quotes by the famous actor, John Houseman, we were damned grateful for what we got. On our end, it wasn't nearly enough. On the federal government end, it wasn't nearly enough, but we were damned grateful to get what we got. It didn't cure the depression. I always thought that was a cheap shot. But what it did was it primed the pump, got some people back to working, and reduced unemployment. I think we're in the same kind of a situation now, where the problem continues to compound. And no, $1,400, the balance of the $2,000 that Democrats were calling for, $1,400 isn't enough. Of course, there'll be that much for families of four, $1,400 each. There is a widely expanded child tax care credit. All of that, tremendously helpful, not enough on either end. Something has to be done and people will be damned grateful. And especially for those with no immediate prospects of going back to work. This is a full package that has to deal with the here and now. Sure, the budget has to be considered, but in the here and now, there are people who are suffering at the moment and with low prospects for the future. And so I think that the $1.9 trillion is horribly inadequate, but at least at the moment, it's the kind of Band-Aid and possibly ACE bandage together with a Band-Aid that makes all the sense in the world.
You know, I don't know. Maybe it's my inexperienced millennial perspective, but if we draw the historical analogy of FDR, we have to remember that the United States was in a much different position during the 30s in terms of its economic and financial standings. You know, I immediately think of the economist Ken Rogoff, who argues that, so let's talk debt to GDP ratio. When a nation's GDP reaches 90%, when a nation's debt is 90% of the GDP, that is a critical threshold. And so here we are on this day, and our debt to GDP ratio is 130%. We've crossed that. We crossed that a while ago. And so yes, there's pain right now. There is suffering. I am very well aware of that. But what I can't help think about as somebody with two little ones is, what about the pain in the future? So if we think short-sightedly about how do we relieve the pain right now, all we're doing is pushing that pain to a future generation, because at some point the piper has to be paid. I mean, that's how it's been throughout civilization. I really wonder if we've reached a point in human history where the laws of economics and the laws of history no longer matter. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we're at that point in evolution where you know, new laws are going to emerge and everything before no longer matters. But I can't help but worry about my children and my grandchildren and the debt that's going to be pushed onto them, because we're only focusing on the present. That's the situation we put ourselves in, where we're so short-sighted that we can't even think about the future, yet we're potentially ruining future generations. And that's not very humanitarian.
We need to separate the moment from the plan for the future. Right now, hearts beats charts. This is a moment for heart. The moment for charts and planning, you know, to alleviate, you know, like Roosevelt, relief, recovery, reform. The time for reform will come, but at the moment right now, people need immediate relief. And I do have to sign off.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jer, and thanks, everybody.
Thank you.